Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest on this episode of The Director's Chair is the Brookings Institution scholar and former Russia advisor to President Donald Trump, Dr. Fiona Hill. Fiona is one of the world's leading Russia experts. She worked in the US government under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and then served for 2 years in the Trump administration. She became world famous following her testimony in the impeachment hearings at the end of last year into Donald Trump's presidency. And indeed, she's one of the very few Trump administration figures to emerge with her reputation wholly intact, indeed enhanced. In fact, she may be unique in that respect. So I'm delighted she's agreed to join me today from a home in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Fiona Hill.
Thanks to you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Fiona, I want to start by asking about your origin story. You were born in a little town called Bishop Auckland in northern England in 1965, and your dad was a miner and your mum was a midwife. And the men in your family have been coal miners for generations, and you said that your family always struggled with poverty. Tell us a bit about what it was like to grow up in Bishop Auckland.
Well, it was a bit grim. And, you know, in some respects, you know, the town still has a kind of a grim, countenance to it, although there are efforts to regenerate it. When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, I was born in 65, a lot of the major businesses, the once thriving department stores were going out of business, closing up. The shops were sort of cannibalized, you know, big department stores divided up into other little shops. Shops were getting boarded up, you know, with the industry leaving the town. The main thing that I remember as a kid, because I didn't have a telephone, we didn't have a TV, we didn't have a car, was the big event was going down the town on a Saturday, mostly in the hope of seeing people, you know, wandering up and down the town. And, you know, well, you couldn't window shop and half of them were boarded up. But there was a kind of still, you know, the idea of the old town high street as being a kind of meeting place where you'd run into relatives and friends who otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have much contact with.
How does a young woman from County Durham become interested in Soviet studies and Russian history?
It was really the timing. You know, though I was growing up in this down-on-its-luck town, people were pretty well informed about what was going on. The 1980s were, of course, a period of, you know, quite a lot of not just social tensions and political upheaval, but there was also the standoff that was emerging in the Cold War, the peak of the Cold War. And we had the crisis over the stationing of the SS-20s and Pershing missiles in Europe, the so-called Euro crisis, missile crisis that people talk about. And so at the backdrop of this war scare, all the films about the potential nuclear Armageddon, all of the beginning of, you know, what would then lead up to the arms negotiation between Gorbachev and Reagan later on in the 1980s. That was the time when I decided to go and try to study Russian at university. There were all kinds of opportunities for scholarships to go off and study Russian in that time frame.
All right, I want to come back to your love affair with Russia really over a long time, but let me ask you first about how you came to America. You said in the Trump impeachment hearings that you were an American by choice. And I was interested when you said, basically, I think you came to the US because you felt there were more professional opportunities in America for you. And you said, if I can quote, "I grew up poor with a very distinctive working class accent. In England in the 80s and 90s, this would have impeded my professional development." So did you mean that you felt that someone with your background and your accent wouldn't have thrived in the Foreign Office or the MOD or Whitehall in those days? Is that what you meant?
I do, actually. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of evidence to back that up. You know, there were a lot of barriers to getting ahead professionally. And a number of people were saying, well, look, there's plenty of people from the Northeast out there. And some of the examples they used were comedians. And yeah, that's true. There are lots of comedians and entertainers from the northeast of England. I didn't want to be a comedian. I wanted to be a professional. And when I started on that pathway to see, you know, how I could, you know, indeed, as you're suggesting, take a pathway to something like the diplomatic service and others, people kept saying, well, you need elocution lessons. You know, without accent, you're not going to get very far. And if you really start to think about, you know, the prominent people from Northern England and Northeast of England, people have had regional accents who were in politics and elsewhere. You know, even Margaret Thatcher, who came from Grantham, she had a complete makeover, you know, voice coaching. You know, outside of sort of the regional areas, at the time I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, you did not see many professional people with a Northeast of England accent.
Well, let me ask you, how much has it changed? Because, for example, in Boris Johnson, Britain has its 20th Prime Minister who was educated at Eton College. Do you think it would still be hard for a young Fiona Hill these days to become an important player in British foreign policy?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I think you can kind of like see that when you do look at the composition right now of the British government. I mean, there's a striking lot. I mean, even my friends who went to Cambridge say, hey, they're all from Oxford. And they all say PPE, and they were all in the Oxford Debating Society, so we could go beyond Eton. There's not a very diverse, let's just say, pool of people there today, even though, you know, all plenty smart and, you know, lots of accomplishments there. But you're really just not seeing that kind of social mixing. And that was what attracted me, first of all, to the States. And I think what attracted, you know, a lot of my relatives who went to Australia or went to Canada, you know, it was more difficult to move to London or more difficult to kind of move up in the UK system with the class system, discrimination against based on what your father did, where you're from, your accent, the school you went to. Those are the questions that people are always asking you. Mm. And that already seemed to put you in a box that made it less likely that you would be able to move on. And you know, everybody should be able to have that kind of mobility and be able to, you know, achieve their potential.
You broke out of the box. You went to America. You went to Harvard. You worked at the Kennedy School and various other places. You joined the Brookings Institution in 2000. So you were becoming part of the US foreign policy ecosystem. It's an unusual kind of ecosystem, and Ben Rhodes famously and unkindly referred to it as the blob. It's not something that you see in many other countries. It's got a sort of a variable success rate, for example. I remember that most of the foreign policy establishment nearly 20 years ago were in favor of the Iraq War, for example, and now most of them would say it was a catastrophic disaster. What was it like then joining the foreign policy establishment, and what are the strengths and weaknesses, do you think, of this community?
Well, a lot of the strengths are in the fact that you can actually have people going in and out of government in a way that, you know, you don't in many other settings. And, you know, in theory, when it works really well, you know, with think tanks like Brookings and many others, if, you know, they're well established as non-partisan and, you know, becoming kind of repositories for, you know, people really thinking outside of the box on policy, and then sort of taking those fresh ideas in and then kind of coming out and having learned the hard way that lots of these policy ideas don't really actually work when you're confronted with real life and you might have to rethink. But then, you know, you start that cycle again of reassessing and trying to come up with new ideas. I mean, that actually does play a very important role in refreshing. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is what you were just laying out at the beginning, was if everybody comes from the same background. Mm. And I think you see in the foreign policy establishment a lot more of that than you do in other fields. When I first got to Brookings in the foreign policy program in 2000, and I'd had a similar experience at Harvard when I was working at the Kennedy School, I'd often be the only woman in a meeting. That was, you know, kind of difficult. When you think about diversification beyond gender, minorities of racial, you know, people coming in from all kinds of different backgrounds, also socioeconomic, that's really taken a lot of time to catch up. And a lot of that is rooted in the way that the system has replicated itself. Internships, lots of people can't afford them. You know, a lot of people in poor neighborhoods and poor schools in the United States and elsewhere don't know about all of these opportunities. Mm. You really need to kind of get a sense of a lot of this from high school onwards, not just in college. And, you know, we haven't been great about reaching out beyond the classic Ivy Leagues and others with, you know, strong traditional foreign policy, international affairs, international security. As we see, given all the crises we have to deal with, we need to speed that up a bit. There's a lot more necessity now for, you know, breaking out of these molds and, you know, getting more diversity of thinking as well as people in.
So you joined the NIC working on Russia and Eurasia. So let me ask you about Vladimir Putin, who has become something of your life's work, I guess, in a way. In 2015, you wrote that Putin was arguably the most powerful individual in the world. He seems like a fairly unprepossessing character from a distance. So how's he pulled this off?
Well, he's been extraordinarily good at inventing himself or inventing many selves in the process. Even the unprepossessing character was a bit of a shtick. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a kind of a way of lulling people into sort of thinking that he wasn't something that they needed to contend with or pay an awful lot of attention to. He's very good at networking and creating contacts, very good at kind of hiding his own ambition. Mm-hmm. He becomes the deputy mayor working in the office of his former law professor, who he'd cultivated a very good personal relationship with. And he uses all of these connections to constantly, it's almost like moving on among a monopoly board, starting with one of the kind of small and desirable places and then, moving on. And at all times, he collects information on people.
Mm.
And then once he gets himself into the inner court of Yeltsin and, maneuvers himself into kind of various positions there, it's at that kind of point when he's named the successor, the person who everybody thinks will do what they want, when, it becomes kind of more apparent that all along, he had at the forefront of his mind, not just the back of his mind, that he was going to be the one.
Mm.
He starts this whole process of self-invention to become the first populist celebrity president, doing everything from presenting himself as a kind of a James Bond action figure for the KGB national security types to a nightclub crooner. We see him playing at the piano, not singing particularly great, but just enough to, thrill the middle-aged women, in his kind of constituency there. Conservationist by saving endangered cranes and flying a microlight with a funny outfit on, or archaeologist by diving down into the not-so-deep part of the Black Sea to bring up an ancient amphora, to meeting with youth groups, to, this, that, and the other, ice hockey, you name it. He's been doing everything because he's going to be somebody for everybody. And that unprepossessing persona is very useful. It's almost that he can transform himself
into
anything anybody wants him to be. It's camouflage.
And what's he like in person? You've met him a number of times over the course of your career.
Yeah, he's very sharp. I mean, he's very well prepared. Over time, I think he's become a bit more complacent, as most people do when they're in power for so long and they become conscious of their own indispensability. But, he's somebody who, kind of has done his homework for the most part. I've occasionally seen where maybe he's been distracted by something and, he's made the odd mistake.
Mm.
But this is somebody who, kind of knows his brief, knows all of his topics, and is, just always trying to feel out the weaknesses of others. And he likes to, make a poke at people as well, push their buttons, try to get a ride, try to see, put them on their back foot, obviously trying to figure out each time how we can manipulate the person that he's interacting with and how we can move them in the direction that he obviously, wants to take them.
So in 2017, you joined the Trump administration to work really on Russia and European affairs and to prepare the president for his various interactions with President Putin. You've referred to this as your strange adventures in government. You did so against the advice of many, I believe, many of your closest friends and colleagues. One of my favourite books about Washington is What I Saw at the Revolution by Peggy Noonan, who worked for the Reagan administration. I remember Peggy writes in that book that everybody who works at the White House goes through three stages. The first is to say, this is the White House, what am I doing here? And the second stage is, this is the White House, yeah, I deserve to be here. And the third stage is, this is the White House, what are all these other people doing here? Did you go through those three stages at the White House?
I don't think I ever quite got past the first stage, really. I mean, when I got pinching myself thinking, oh my God, what am I, trying to do here? Given the parties on politics around the 2016 elections, everyone was digging dirt up on each other. Everybody was fighting with each other. And there was a sort of sense that one part of the country was pitted against the other, each with their avatars in a vicious video game almost in many respects. That's kind of how I felt. And then in the midst of all of that, you have the Russians deciding that they're going to try to jump into this, in their mind, out of a sense of vengeance for what they think that the United States has been doing to them since Putin tried to return to the presidency in 2011 and 2012, but also as a kind of revenge for all the humiliations that they perceive have been inflicted upon them since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hubris of the United States at the end of the Cold War. This is just, for them, an opportunity to pay something back. And knowing all of this and having spent a long time, working on Putin and seeing the way this was all unfolded, I had a real kind of sense of like the US house was on fire. And I felt like I really needed to do something, and I was asked unexpectedly to go in. I wasn't seeking this. A certain amount of, rather, strange encounters with people who ended up, kind of being right there in the center, or, former professional encounters with people led me to that position. I felt like, well, I'd been asked to serve and I should do something. I mean, otherwise, what was the whole point of, building up all of this work, this experience, the inside of and outside of government that we talked about? I'd been in the National Intelligence Council. I knew how all this worked. I had a pretty good sense of what the Russians were doing. And so I should try to get in there and see what I could do. And then, of course, I discovered that there was an awful lot more going on than I'd ever anticipated inside of the White House. that last point about what are all these other people doing there was a good question. I had the politics, the domestic politics, was even more complex than I'd anticipated. And that's the strange adventures I was referring to. Because I was kind of acutely aware of, oh my God, you know, suddenly I'm here in the White House. I never, you know, expected that. And certainly not in these circumstances. And I also gave myself a 2-year time frame. I did not want to get sucked in to maybe into that second part of the observation. Oh, well, I just want to be here. Because I was in there with a job to do. And I didn't want to start, you know, kind of thinking that I'm indispensable, because that's just never true. And you're always there as part of a team. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure that I could try to be as effective as I could be and to get out no matter, you know, no matter what, within a reasonable time frame, so that I wasn't getting kind of sucked in, you know, to doing more than I was capable of doing. You know, have to be well aware of your own limitations as well.
So there's a lot of speculation about Donald Trump's policy towards Vladimir Putin. And it is true, I think, for an outsider and a non-expert like me, that the persistence of his affinity for Putin is something that strikes you, whether it's siding with Putin over the US intelligence community on Russian interference in the 2016 election, or inviting Russia to attend the G7 Plus summit that's supposedly scheduled for September, or even last week you saw when he was asked in that Axios interview about Russia's practice of arming the Taliban, he responded with those sort of Russian-style talking points. Well, we did the same thing with the Mujahideen back in the 80s. There's probably no one who's thought more about this question than you. How do you explain Donald Trump's affinity for Putin and Russia?
I don't think it's an affinity for Russia. Let's just make it clear right here. And I want to be very careful about, you know, how I speak about this, because we still have to deal with Russia, you know, moving forward. And I think we have to be, you know, very clear when we look at the style of the president and his own background. He isn't a foreign policy, national security person. He's a businessman. And he views things as he's the CEO of a business. And I think that he brought that approach, as everybody knows and he sees it, to the White House. And his belief is it's his job, you know, to have charisma, you know, kind of charismatic individual with another charismatic individual, as kind of like the CEO of the other entity, to build up a personal chemistry to get things done and have a deal. And he looks at that as kind of on the individual level. So he doesn't see any difference between Putin, Xi, Netanyahu, Erdogan, the Queen. I mean, I could go down a whole load of lists, you know, the Australian counterparts, you know, any other leader. So you have to kind of think about this as sort of personal style. He's also not somebody who was steeped in the previous policies of any other administration. Mm. He does not see himself as continuing any deep American policy. Mm. For him, it's a fresh start. He said that over and over again. The president's view of Putin is divorced from, you know, the previous policy and national security perspective that has gone before. And he's very focused on creating an affinity and a personal relationship with Putin and the idea that then he can get things done.
But why Putin in particular? Because, I mean, in general,
in particular, Michael, it's also Xi. There's been a lot of criticism.
Yeah, especially
about
authoritarian leaders.
The Queen, is she an authoritarian leader? It's what he sees as the person themselves, the role that they play. I mean, the Pope. I mean, he's been very keen on meeting with the Pope as well.
But not the Chancellor of Germany, not particularly Mrs. May in the UK. I mean, there is a lean towards authoritarian leaders, isn't that true?
There is a hierarchy of leaders and people who he sees as being, you know, kind of leaders, celebrity figures, people who are viewed internationally with a lot of name recognition. I'm just going to leave it at that.
What would you say then about the kompromat theory, that there's something that Putin has on President Trump?
Putin has something on absolutely everybody he interacts with. And that might just be, and it gets back to what I said before about his sense of your weaknesses and vulnerabilities and how he can, you know, he has talked about himself with great pride about his speciality is dealing with people, and that's manipulating people. That's, you know, kind of working with people. He talked about it actually more than dealing with people, it's just working with people. That's his skill. He sees that, you know, kind of what is it that motivates and drives the other person? And what is it they could either use to push their buttons? And, you know, you mentioned Chancellor Merkel of Germany, where Putin famously very well, you know, publicly described episode now, knew she was scared of dogs after a nasty incident where she was bitten, and sent in his back Labrador, kind of large back Labrador, pretty friendly. But if you're scared of dogs, not something you're going to feel very comfortable with when it comes into a room in an official setting to sniff around your feet. Definitely, you know, intended to throw her off balance. And, you know, in the view of just kind of showing her that he could do that. Now, she, you know, kind of pushed back on this. That's not the kind of, you know, thing that someone like Chancellor Merkel, you know, takes particularly lightly. But so my point is that Putin is always looking for something that he can use with others. So it doesn't have to be the classic idea of compromat or something of blackmail. It's just, how do you interact with that person, you know, to get what you want and to draw them in and to, you know, move them in a certain direction. So I think often we think about things in the wrong way. There's always this sort of assumption about, oh, we must have this on that person, or I must have that on another. But it's really about what kind of information does he know about the person that he can use, you know, to basically push Russia's interests.
Dominate them.
His own view.
All right. So let me fast forward. You spent about 2 years in the administration. In November last year, you appeared as a witness in the impeachment inquiry into charges of abuses of power and obstruction of Congress against President Trump. And in your public testimony, with your mix of straight talk and self-deprecation, you were really a standout performer, and you were described as a national treasure. Hashtag Fiona Hill fan club was trending on Twitter. Was that surreal to be in the middle of that after 2 years of these strange adventures in the Trump administration to come out the other end and get this incredible kind of response and validation? What was that like?
Well, the response was completely surreal. I mean, in the moment, I wasn't even contemplating that that would be, you know, one of the effects. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, basically trying to continue, you know, what I saw as, you know, doing my duty in the job and, you know, believing in the role of Congress and, you know, congressional oversight. And, you know, when you're subpoenaed, you should show up and, you know, just give your best assessment of the facts and, you know, present things as they are. That was what I was doing. I mean, I was aware the whole world was watching, including Russians. And the way that we have been throwing so much dirt against each other, we've got to fight in the personalization of everything, that's giving them even more ammunition to use for later. You know, still extraordinarily worried that the more we get into character assassination, I'm well aware that, you know, kind of there are many individuals in our politics are doing this, but I'm not going to feed into that. And the one thing that was really struck me in the middle of this was just how, you know, the members of Congress were not seeing themselves necessarily as entirely, you know, carrying out their oversight role, but they were seeing each other as part of opposing armies, not as Americans. I mean, this was, you know, an exercise in the Constitution. This was the Constitution at work. And yet, you know, we were seeing two warring sides. And I was deeply disturbed and extraordinarily worried, you know, by the nature of the partisan fighting. And I kept trying to get across that, you know, look, our adversaries are watching here, and what we say, what we're doing here, is giving other people ideas about how they can manipulate us going forward. And, you know, I want to say again that, you know, that President Trump is not the cause of all of the kind of things that are happening. He is, you know, kind of a product of, you know, basically a political system that has started to eat itself away. And the style of governance, you know, we see this all over the world at the moment, you know, in the UK, in Russia, in many European countries, you know, in Turkey and in China. You know, we've got ourselves into a situation here where it's actually rare, you know, to kind of see countries pulling together, you know, as we're seeing now in the pandemic, the weaknesses and the vulnerabilities that our systems are creating because of all of this infighting.
Let me ask you, what do you make of the arguments that the United States should work more closely with Russia to balance or to counter the rise of China?
You see, this gets back to what you were just saying. You mentioned the G7. You know, this is actually kind of the viewpoint of many within the administration that, you know, Putin, you know, putting all aside all the things we've talked about here, and Russia should be invited to the G7, you know, to basically join in a coalition against China. Well, first of all, the Russians don't want to do that. You know, I mean, I know in Australia you've been going through a massive national debate about China, you know, and the relationship, very close relationship Australia had before. You know, there's been an awful lot of debate about this. And in the case of Russia, you know, they've very clearly decided that they want to have a partnership with China, that they see China as a positive, you know, for them rather than a negative over the longer term. And they most certainly do not want to be pulled into an anti-China coalition. And they make that very clear. And so, you know, I do think that we should be engaging with Russia. We've got to push back against all the actions that Russia's been taking that have really caused an awful lot of problems for us, not just the interference in our election system and their attempts to undermine our democracy, but other things that they've been doing in Europe and elsewhere. But we do have to try to find a way of working with the Russians in a professional manner on many of the issues that we're contending with right now, on the pandemic, on climate change, and many other problems. So we can't be always in this confrontational situation with Russia, but we're not going to change it by saying, hey, come and join us in an anti-China coalition. That's just not going to work.
Let me ask, you mentioned interference. We know that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. Do you think they are now trying to interfere in the 2020 election, and do you think they'll be successful?
They're definitely, you know, trying to take advantage of all of the, you know, weaknesses and, you know, the kind of infighting stuff that I've described for sure. I mean, I think for the Russians, they think this is just fair game. Mm. And in fact, you'll find that most Russians are kind of incredulous that we'd be so upset about what happened in 2016. I mean, we really did have a failure of imagination collectively in the US to think that the Russians wouldn't do or wouldn't try what they've always tried, you know, in the Soviet period. And, you know, wouldn't try to do to us what they've been doing elsewhere. You know, we saw, you know, the Russians were kind of messing about or trying to mess about on the electoral systems. We've actually plugged a lot of those holes and addressed a lot of those issues. The problem is really the attempts to hack the minds to sway public opinion or to mess about the hack and release kind of operations, piling on discrediting political opponents to sow chaos and to reduce American voters' confidence in the electoral systems. That's definitely something they're trying to do. Now, why are they doing it is the question. It's because they want to kind of, you know, weaken the United States' international leadership and to get the US out of their affairs, in their view. Mm. For Putin, they want the US to be out of the picture. Mm. You know, so Putin can, you know, move on whatever it is he's wanting to do. Mm. And obviously, a weakened United States gives, you know, Russia more freedom of maneuver in Russia's view.
One of the crazy things for an Australian observer is not just that you don't have mandatory voting, because I know that's quite unusual, but that there's so much partisan disputation about so many elements of the electoral system that you don't have a really independent national electoral authority, you don't have consistent electoral laws, voting methods. I mean, it's insane.
I feel the same way, you know, and, you know, I think that having looked at this, you know, so much in other settings, I mean, my whole expertise was really on other countries. Mm. You know, I've started to kind of wonder if, you know, we could do a little bit of the stuff at home in the United States that we've been always looking at abroad. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be fixed. And there's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people are asking questions now about the electoral system. It's an 18th century electoral system, which is actually the same in the UK. It's interesting that, you know, the UK and, you know, Britain and the United States both parted company in the 18th century. Mm. Always, you know, in a pretty acrimonious way, but they've still kind of both maintained these 18th century electoral systems. Mm.
Final question, Fiona, what's next for you? You're the policy wonk who popped, as it were. You've had these strange adventures. Are you enjoying being back in the quieter life at Brookings? Obviously, even quieter during COVID, but what would you like to do next? Can you imagine yourself going back for more strange adventures in government?
Well, it really depends. I mean, what I am about to do is really try to embark on a book that pulls together some of these threads that we've been talking about, not about my strange adventures, you know, kind of in the White House or, you know, but really kind of bringing some of these themes together about how we all get here and using some of my personal, you know, perspectives from growing up in an incredibly highly charged, very tense, polarized period in the UK against this backdrop of inequality and poverty. And, you know, kind of, unfortunately, for an awful lot of people today, it's the same thing. Mm. I mean, what disturbed me the most is the opportunities that I had to really get ahead are not there for most people now. Mm. And, you know, and I got ahead at a time when only, well, it was about 6% of kids in Britain went to university at all, let alone kids from a comprehensive school like I went to from my background. And, you know, I left school with no debt, which is amazing because everything was paid for and I had fellowships and I was by my local education authority. I came to the United States at a time when there were all kinds of scholarships and things available. But so many people now in the United States and on the UK and elsewhere go into massive debt to get an education. And education isn't transformative in the way that it should be. They don't have, you know, the skills that they need to kind of get ahead in a rapidly changing environment. And so I want to kind of, you know, bring some of this out. And what I fear the most is now, after COVID, you know, the pandemic, that we're kind of back to the 30s. My dad was born in 32. His family were homeless for periods when his father was out of work, living in condemned buildings and you know, basically scraping by on handouts and charity and relatives' help.
My dad actually was also, my dad was a Cockney from the slums of London.
Was he?
He was very smart. In the 11 plus, he got a scholarship to a public school, Latimer Upper, and he went into the film industry. He served in the Second World War, and then he emigrated to Australia in the 60s as a 10-pound pom.
Oh, he's a 10-pound pom as well, yeah.
And he met my mum on the set of Skippy the Bush Kangaroo.
No, Skippy? Oh, my God, I love Skippy.
I know, because my dad was one of the directors of Skippy and my mum was the tutor to Sonny, the boy.
Dear. That's brilliant, Michael. That's brilliant.
No, it's interesting that, you know, sometimes those backgrounds give you the resilience, don't they, and the imagination actually to get out and to change your life and to go to the other side of the world and do something different.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, it becomes so daunting thinking about staying on and doing something in England, honestly, because there's so many barriers, people stopping you, that you know, so many people were pushed to go for much further afield. You know, we have an opportunity to do things differently. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about now. And sadly, I don't think that this election is going to resolve it. And 20 is going to be, you know, a really tough year for all of us to get out of. And it's going to be a process where everyone's going to have to pull together. So I think there's going to be an awful lot of a room for Brookings where, you know, a lot of people are doing cutting edge research on a lot of these issues and, you know, how we fix this situation. And I think, you know, we're all going to have to pull together internationally as well. We're not going to be able to get out of this alone. You know, either a long-term solution for the pandemic, you know, the kinds of changes in the climate that have wrought havoc in Australia. We've got a lot of things to do collectively. And again, I don't think that, you know, being in the executive branch is going to be sufficient. There's going to have to be a lot of people speaking out and trying to mobilize people from the outside. So I'm hoping to be able to do some of that as well. You know, I look forward to Brookings to be able to work with you and the Lowy Institute and, you know, all of our other, you know, great colleagues on trying to take some of this forward.
It's been really fascinating, Fiona, to hear about your life from Bishop Auckland to the White House. So thank you very much for your time and thank you for joining me on the Director's Chair.
No, thanks so much, Michael. It's been really great having this chance to have a talk to you as well.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.